Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And, you know, I've always wondered what our fascination with sweets is all about. I mean, certainly everybody loves a little bit of sugar, a little sweet. You might not have a sweet tooth, as they say, but I'm sure that everyone enjoys, if it's even just a lump of sugar in your coffee, loves the taste of sweets. And why, in fact, are sweets so universally loved? In fact, our affinity for sweetness, as Sidney Mintz mentioned in the foreword to this wonderful book we're going to talk about, permeates our language. Think about it. Sweetie, I said sweet tooth. Honey, sweetheart. Sugar has been, as Sidney Mintz, I'm going to quote something he said. He said, sugar has been a part of New World history of half a millennium and for at least four times that in the Old World. It's a food that has meant much to humans and one that has supplanted its predecessor worldwide. That would be honey, right? And it's a metaphor for so much. It's history brimming over with the cruelty of man to man, but also with thoughts of sweetness and all the pleasures that taste connotes. And Sidney is an anthropologist and historian, author of, amongst many things, Sweetness and Power. So the man knows sugar. And he wrote this foreword in the new Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, which is a fabulous compendium of all things sweet. And someone else who is, quote, worthy is here with me today to talk about it, and that's Dara Goldstein. Dara is the editor-in-chief of this wonderful tome, I have to say, a huge compendium, so large that neither of us brought it into the studio today. And Dara is... She's the founder and former editor of Gastronomica, if many of you know that magazine. It's still in existence. And she is a professor of Russian studies, Russian and language, Russian. At Williams College, and the author of four different Russian cookbooks, as well as many other articles and books. And Dara, I welcome you.
I'm so glad to be back, Linda.
What inspired this book? Now, I will say that I did recently do a show on the history of sugar with Andy Smith. And so we talked about that whole, the whole dark side of sugar and the industrialization and, you know, where, you know, different countries and when it arrived. But this is a little bit of everything. How did you come to do this book?
In a roundabout way, Oxford called and actually asked me if I would do the companion to world food. And I thought, that's not a good project for me. I'll inevitably irritate, alienate, marginalize. I can't really hierarchize the different culinary cultures in the world without making some mistakes, and it wasn't a project that I wanted to take on. But I liked the idea of working with them. They wanted to work with me, and so I said, let me get back to you and think about what I might be able to do. And it came to me almost immediately because I do have one of those so-called sweet tooth. Or I should say sweet teeth in my case, and proposed this, and that's how it all started.
Well, it's interesting because using the term sweet tooth and sugar and spice and everything nice. I mean, it's interesting because you say sugar or sweetness and it sort of automatically makes you smile, and you don't think of that necessarily when you think of spices, you get serious, you know, but there's a lot of seriousness around sweetness.
There is, because it really, if you think about all of the foodstuffs in the world, sugar arguably has had more impact on the course of human history than just about anything else.
Yeah, well, and as Sydney points out in the foreword, that, I mean, it has really altered the course of history in many ways over the past more than 1,000 years.
It has, yeah. For better and for worse.
Yes.
I mean, it's led to extraordinary, beautiful creations, but it's also made us enter into the dark side of things.
Indeed. But you know what? We have, everyone craves a certain food stuff or a flavor, and that's very individual. And yet, as I mentioned, universally, we all are sort of have this fascination with sweets.
We're primed for it. There's an evolutionary reason for it.
Okay.
If you think about way back when people were foraging for food, and not just in a sort of leisurely way or trendy way as we tend to do now, it's a question of survival. We were drawn to whatever was ripe and therefore sweet, because that is what would give energy, and energy was what people needed for sustenance. And also the plants that tended to be bitter would be toxic more likely. Mm-hmm. So the entire urge for survival depended on the sweet. It's interesting, they've done scientific studies that show that even E. coli, these motile bacteria, will tend to go towards sweet substances, even though they don't have brains that are telling them that it's sweet. So it's built into a lot of organisms.
That's interesting. And as far as our palate receptors, I don't know, are there more sweet receptors, we think?
No,
I don't know.
No, it's just that there are receptors that go into the brain, and it is received in the same way that you receive things like cocaine or other areas that give you pleasure. So the dopamine kicks in with sugar.
No wonder they call it a sugar high when little kids get into too much.
It's true. But if you think about the coca leaf, if you were to brew a tea from it, it would be maybe mildly stimulating and not dangerous. It's just that when you refine it down and you get this powder, then it acts very quickly and it goes very directly. It's the same thing with sugar. Sugar is not intrinsically bad for you. If you've ever had wonderful fresh sugarcane juice, it's an absolute delight on a day like it is today in New York
when it's hot and steamy.
It'll refresh you, but it won't do you any harm. It's just when you start refining it down and you get it in its very intense form and have too much of it that becomes problematic.
Mm, indeed. Well, and as you mentioned, people looking foraging for food, and certainly nothing has the caloric impact that sugar has. I mean, that you can get a lot more calories and sustenance from a smaller amount of sugar than it would take. I think the comparison that I read was, you know, in the book, in fact, was it would take 5 times as many acres to get that caloric impact from to raise the cattle that would be comparative.
One thing that is quite interesting to contemplate is that until fairly recently, the past 100 years or so, sugar was a medicine.
Right.
And we talk about a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, but it actually was the medicine. And that goes back to ancient Chinese practice, ancient Ayurvedic practice, and even the system of humoral medicine that Western society relied on for a long time. Because if you assign different properties to food and different properties to people based on the four humors within them, sugar is moist and heating, both of which are really important qualities, because if you're dried up and if you're cold, then sugar was seen as something that would loosen the fluids. So an expectorant, for instance, if you have a lot of phlegm, sugar was prescribed. So it was used and it was very expensive. And even today, if the price of sugar goes up, the price of drugs will go up because it's used to
sugar-coated. Right. Yeah. And sugar-coated. Now, that's interesting, too, because, as you said, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. And medicines, pills are coated with sugar and candy coating. And so when we talk about something that is made a little more palatable or a little more easy to take, a deal, it's sugar coated. I mean, that the language is so imbued with these metaphors. It's
those
terrific.
Are some of my favorite entries in the book. There's one on slang and there's another on sexual euphemisms.
Ah.
And a wonderful appendix on sugar in music, in songs. And so you can really see how language has developed these metaphors that use the idea of the sweet.
Right. Well, now this really is, it is compendium. It's an encyclopedia. Certainly not the complete exhaustive encyclopedia. We were just talking earlier about how ask a kid, they'll find one of their favorite desserts or candies that's not listed. But certainly, as everything that has to do with sugar and sweets around the world, it is truly an incredible encyclopedia. How many contributors are there total, and how did you find them, and where did they all come from?
There are 265 contributors. It's a huge number, but I wanted a lot of different voices in the book. And I seem to know a lot of people, but I also relied on my associate editor, Michael Crondall, and then five area editors, and asked for their input and their expertise. And my wonderful editor at Oxford, Max Sinsheimer, was also very helpful. So there was input from a lot of people.
Yeah. And a lot of the names I did recognize as well, and many of them have been guests here on the show. So I could hear their voice. Obviously, they were writing about their specialties or just something similar to what they've researched. And you're right. It does. It's interesting to read because those voices are very distinctive.
That's good. That was one of the goals. And it's also a book you don't want to read it A to Z. I can't, maybe there are people who enjoy that sort of thing, but to me it's more a volume to dip into. And one of the ways to do that most successfully is to choose an entry, any entry that you think you might be interested in. And at the end of it, there's a cross-reference. So it will take you across the world and through time and through space and lead you to something that you might not have thought about. And that's, I think, the best way to go through the volume.
And many of these writers they're from around the world as well. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was important to get international representation as well.
All right. How did you go about choosing the topics that you were going to assign?
I can't remember the first one that came to mind. I wish I could still, but I thought initially geographically, what places in the world should be represented. I also thought about very important desserts, whether they're iconic for us as Americans or whether they're a generic type or whether they're a certain technique, like I think about meringue, that is relatively new in culinary history. Things like, or marzipan, which is my own favorite sweet, that needed to be in there. But then inevitably, I wanted to bring in cultural history. I wanted to bring in slavery and racism. I wanted to bring in language and literature. I wanted art to be a part of it because it's a very important part of my own life. So there's a beautiful entry on representations of sweets and art, but also the use of things like sugar and chocolate as a medium.
Right.
An artist like Vic Muniz, the Brazilian, who did an amazing series on sugar children based on the kids who are working on St. Kitts, on the sugar plantations. Mm-hmm. And then there are also 32 color plates, beautifully, beautifully reproduced of different images of sugar and art.
Right. And you mentioned, too, that sugar as a medium, I mean, that's, we think immediately in, back in history of what we know about many banquets and cuisines. And it was, well, Marie Antoinette Carême, of course, and all his fantastic sculptures of, sweet sculptures were memorable.
Yes, and it goes back much earlier than that. In medieval times and in the Renaissance, sugar sculptures were the way we would put a centerpiece on the table now, a beautiful flower display or maybe some candles or candelabra. These were made either out of cast sugar, the sugar that was melted and poured into molds that represent all kinds of interesting symbolic shapes, or more often they were made into a sugar paste. And then you could mold it and have whole scenarios that were made out of sugar, and they were breathtaking. And in England, sometimes these were called subtleties, which of course they're anything but subtle, but they also had another name called Warner. And often they would appear in between the removal of the courses on the table to sort of warn people that that was the end of one course, but also be something to delight them while the service was being changed.
Yes, you can eat the centerpiece. Well, I know in, actually, I think it was in maybe towards the Renaissance that a lot of sugar sculptures would be actual tea sets, plates and saucers. Mm-hmm. And yes, you could eat it after you used it.
Yes, beautifully crafted. Yeah. And they were given as favors at very important festivities.
All right. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Byzantine era had a lot of, I mean, you're talking way back, yeah.
Yes, there was a beautiful circumcision procession in Istanbul in late 16th century, I think. And to honor the Sultan and his son, something like 300 confectioners carried, sometimes four men at a time were needed to carry these huge sculptures in honor of the boy's circumcision.
And all with sugar.
Yes.
It's interesting. Well, what I would like to do is talk about a few of the entries and a few of your favorite, stories when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Listening to Write It Down by The Landing. This is A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.org.
Be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, we are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm speaking with Dara Goldstein, the editor-in-chief of Sugar and Sweets, the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, an encyclopedia of everything you ever wanted to know about sugar, and then some.
And everything you didn't know about sugar.
Right, and the then some. I mean, it's thousands of years of sugar around the globe, and I was interested to see that there were biographies included too of people who had, if not direct influence, you know, even a distant influence. But before that, you talked about art and how the art was so important to you. The cover of the book is just, I mean, it's drool worthy.
There's a little drip of sugar, yeah. Sugar and, glaze.
And so many of us just assumed it was a beautiful photograph of this wonderful fruit tart.
No, it's a painting by Roberto Benedicente.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it is just bigger than life. And it's so realistic, you know, the painting. But what a fantastic cover, because you just look at it and you start, you know,
salivating
and thinking about sugar. And the another thing that was interesting, we talked about how, you know, everyone just sort of had, I think Americans during a certain period of time went through a heavy addiction to sugar. I mean, candy was viewed as a food, actually, too. The woman who wrote that book was candy.
Samira Kawash.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
she's
I couldn't remember. Her name. Yes, and she was on the show as well and shared her information about that. But why I just had to share the photograph, which I did on one of the social media, of the World War I poster of the ration, sugar rationing, that Americans would be allowed only 2 pounds a month of sugar, as opposed to, you know, the usual 20 pounds a month that we were consuming. 2 pounds a month. That's a ration?
Yeah, but you have to keep in mind that much of it was used for preserving.
Because people were still
doing a lot of their own preserving then, so I don't believe it all went straight into the gullet.
That explains it. Well, of course I should have realized that, right? Yeah. Got to make those jams and put up the the jellies, right? Okay, whew, I was a little concerned there. I asked you the question, how did you think of the topics to assign to all these different writers? I mean, that you had to do all the research initially.
I did, but that was really the pleasurable part, because it was a conceptual part, and I always love that.
And then think about it.
And then
okay,
the editing comes in.
Right. What were some of, anything that surprised you when some of the authors got into a topic?
One of the ones that really intrigued me was unusual uses of sugar, because we tend to think of sugar as a substance that's very familiar, and probably we don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but it has had some extraordinary applications, you could say. In Hollywood, it used to be used to make glass, so that whenever someone was thrown through a window and the glass shattered, it was sugar. They use some kind of resin now. One of the quirkier things is, I think they discovered this in Poland, but it was recent, I think as recently as last summer, used in England. There were some rotting medieval bridges with timbers in Leicester, and they found that if they soaked those timbers in a 67% sugar solution, then it created a barrier so that the microorganisms couldn't get in and they could preserve. I mean, it's the same principles as preserving fruits, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So sugar as a preservative, but also for historical buildings that are made out of wood.
Huh.
And they're using it now in 3D printing.
Yes.
To not just make extraordinary sculptures that are the 21st century iteration of the kind of things that Carême was doing, but to create artificial organs.
Mm.
It hasn't been perfected yet, but there are a lot of experiments being done. So it's extraordinary the uses that sugar can be put to.
Wow. That is surprising that I didn't read. I did not read all the entries.
I'll give you a list at the end. And that brings me to another one that is unusual uses of sugar, but spills over into sartorial sweets, which is just a wonderful idea about wearing sugar. And of course, we can think about the Salon du Chocolat, where you have these creations and women walk down the runway wearing chocolate confections, mm-hmm. literally. But they're making a fabric now from lightly sweetened green tea, and the bacteria collect on the top of the tea. They create a kind of raft that is fairly thick. They lift it off, they dry it, and they turn it into a fabric.
Huh. Is it edible?
I don't know that you'd want to eat it. It's meant to be worn.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. And, you know, it's interesting because you think when you said a lot of microorganisms, even E. coli, are attracted to sugar and go there. So that's, and yet we think of it as a preservative as well.
Yes.
Oh, it has some changes there. You have a few things that you do like to talk about too, the sartorial sweets, but one thing I was telling my grandson about, he got a big kick out of it, and that's the pie tin.
Oh, frisbees.
Frisbees,
so
right.
Frisbee, this all-American sport, it actually originated with a pie tin. There was a man named William Frisbee in Connecticut, and he worked for a pie company in New Haven, and he decided to open a branch in Bridgeport. And he named it after himself, so it was the Frisbee Pie Company. And he made the pies in these tin pie plates, and embossed on them was Frisbee Pie Company, because when you got them, it's like with returnable bottles. You paid a 5-cent deposit right on the pie plate, and then you were supposed to return it. But sometime in the 1920s or 30s, it honestly isn't clear, college kids who loved these pies started playing with them and not returning them. So Yale, of course, claims it because they are right there in New Haven. But then Harvard, being Yale's rival, claims the origin, and Middlebury apparently claims it too. But at any rate, somewhere on some college campus in the Northeast, these kids started throwing the pie plates. And then in the 1940s, with America's infatuation with flying saucers, and later into the 1950s with the real space age, the Wham-O company saw these tins, and then they turned it into Frisbees.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of nice. I mean, I think it's very nice that they attributed the name. They gave the name Frisbee after and attributed it to the man who
started the pie tin. They spelled it differently.
Now you're going to tell me that the hula hoop started out as a sugar rattle.
Once I learned about the Frisbee, I really wanted the hula hoop to. I was always better at the hula hoop than at playing Frisbee.
There are, and that actually is interesting because that comes under the section of biographies, as does one on Zazu Pitts.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, so she actually pronounces her name Zazu, which is totally counterintuitive, but she was a silent screen star who had these enormous, enormous eyes and sort of a pouty face. And she was the darling of Hollywood until the talkies came, and then she wasn't quite as well known, although she continued to play character roles for a very long time. But she was known for her fluttery fingers. She always had this affect that whenever anything agitated her, her fingers would begin to flutter in this very evocative way. But those fingers, it turns out, were really adept at making candy. And in the early 60s, she was known throughout Hollywood because she would bring candy, homemade candy, to the studio wherever she went. People loved her. And she had a special kitchen built in a house that was designed by the same man who designed LAX. And it had a completely round kitchen. And it had marble where she could make these temperature-sensitive candies. And she published a book in 1961, I think, called Candy Hits by Zazu Pitts.
Candy Hits.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful cookbook. It has very easy-to-follow recipes. And I just did a blog about her for the OUP blog, if anyone wants to check it out, under the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets page on the Oxford University Press website.
Oh, there's we'll definitely have to look for that.
Yeah, extra section on Zazu Pitts.
Oh, interesting. what, as far as any, there are sweets, given the history and description of sweets from all over the world, was there any that was, struck you, that that was unusual? Obviously, you picked the topics, but did someone come up with something that what's the most far-flung foreign sweet?
Oh, the most far-flung foreign foreign sweet.
Hate to throw that one out at you unexpectedly.
You know,
but
the thing is, I don't think that I found anything particularly Outre. There is one entry on gag candy.
I actually saw that.
Yeah, and so those would be really, really sour candies or really, really hot candies. That's an American thing. And if you think about it, that is very strange. You could think about some of the candied insects, chocolate-covered ants. And I suppose that that would be far flung. But there wasn't anything that mystified me particularly. The thing that did mystify me was learning about castoreum. Now, that did shock me. Castoreum comes from the castor sacs, which are found in beavers. And for many years, they have this... castor has been used for making perfumes. It has the scent of musk.
Peach blossom or musky?
It's very musky. Yeah. And also in medicine. But so the castor sacs are either milked or else they're removed from the beavers when the beavers are not alive. And it becomes a hard resin that then can be dissolved in oil or made liquid and then added. And they found in the 1920s that it added a kind of vanilla flavor to baked goods.
The culinary historians of New York just did a program on the science of flavors, and that was spoken about. That was almost an accidental discovery.
Yes,
in processing this castor oil, they discovered that it was it mimicked vanilla.
Yes, the thing that some listeners might find disturbing is that because it's a natural substance, it's not listed on any ingredients list.
Right.
So I don't think it's used that often because beaver posteriors are hard to find these days. They're in decline. But beware.
And that gives a little boon to imitation flavors.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. The other things that I thought of was Concord grapes. They're interesting. Sweetness, you were talking about. In nature, you know, we go towards things that are ripe, that have a sweetness. And yet birds won't touch Concord grapes because there's something. I have written it down, but I can't remember the chemical that it is that causes them to have an irritant, like they're cause their trigeminal nerve to freeze up. And
so luckily we're human and can enjoy Concord grape jam and Concord grape pie.
Exactly. And the sweetness, I mean, that has been used to flavor so many other things too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. Tell me, what about, we talked about the dark side that I had covered, and people can look for my show on sugar with Andy Smith about the industrialization of the sugar refining. But child labor is something that we had not discussed on that show, and it's something that you cover in this book.
Yes. When we think about child labor, at least where I live in New England, it's the textile mills and the very striking and painful photographs of Lewis Hine at the beginning of the 20th century. It turns out that he also has some photographs of children who are working in confectionery factories. There's one really striking one from a confectionery factory in Dallas where the kids are only 10 to 12 years old and he interviews them and they say, yes, we have to pretend that we're 14. And what I find so complex is they're working for pennies so that they can buy the newly available penny candy. And so there's something very insidious about it. Cracker Jack, this wonderful American company, actually was one of the worst for child labor at the beginning of the 20th century, no longer. But where the problem is now is in Ivory Coast and Ghana to a lesser degree, and that has to do with agricultural labor, with the harvesting of cacao to make chocolate. And there have been all kinds of international protocols to work against allowing kids as young as 7 or 8 to labor on the cacao plantations, but it has not been addressed sufficiently. So that's problematic.
And cacao has such a is so intrinsically involved with sugar as well, because it went from just being more of a bitter drink,
yes,
to then becoming a sought-after confection, but mm-hmm. you needed sugar.
Right.
Yeah, so you have two complex industries with a lot of dark sides to them, you know, mm-hmm. combining, and it's really...
For our own pleasure.
For our own pleasure, yeah. For the sweetness.
So I just think it's not that we shouldn't enjoy these things, because we should, but it's always useful to think about the backstory.
Right, right, exactly. Well, there are just stories upon stories. There are, how many entries total are there?
600, or maybe only 599. I'm not sure. Maybe we kept it just short of six, but basically okay, six.
Well, we could call it about 600. 600, yeah. But it is quite a book, and beautiful photographs, and interesting stories and information I would have never thought about. Involving sugar and sweets. It's sort of everything you, as you say, didn't know or wanted to know, or didn't even think you wanted to know, but so interesting. It's the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. And Dara Goldstein, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Linda.
And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.